Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, which has been our third decent week in a row in American politics, which is shocking, albeit a slow one with Congress and a lot of other political players on vacation. But some Congress critters did fly back to watch Joe Biden sign the Inflation Reduction Act, which we discussed on last week's show, into law. We're going to be joined today by a favorite of ours. Sarah Posner is one of the premier journalists tracking the religious right, the author of several books, and an old friend of mine. We're going to talk to her about how evangelical Christians are reacting to the execution of a search warrant at Donald Trump's tacky golf club down in Florida. And I hope I don't spoil it for you when I say that they aren't handling it well, not like you would expect grownups to handle these things. But first, in related news, closely related news, it also looks like Kash Patel may be headed towards possible criminal charges. And if you aren't familiar with that name, if you're a normal person who doesn't pay attention to all the ins and outs of the Trump crime family, he is a particularly unhinged wingnut. One of those people, there's a lot of them, who makes you wonder if he can really be that crazy or if it's a con, if he knows he's full of bullshit. But he has been disseminating conspiracy theories from within the government, which is from within the government, from within the intelligence community. Patel used to work for former California Congressman Devin Nunes, who was the chair of the House Intelligence Committee when the Republicans controlled it. Then Trump first made him part of his national security staff. There, according to many reports, he fed Rudy Giuliani and also Trump all sorts of nonsense about Ukraine intervening in the 2016 election to help Clinton. Then Trump later installed him in the Department of Defense just in time to not call out the National Guard on January 6th. He was one of a small crew of Trump loyalists in the Department of Defense at the last moment. And then he was reportedly pushing a lot of these craziest election fraud conspiracy theories, stuff about like Italy hacking voting machines, right? Or the Venezuela hacking voting machines. There was one that had that the American army had like made a raid in Italy. Just really bonkers stuff. Now, I should say it's not a certainty that he'll be charged, but this week it emerged that he had publicly vowed to release classified information on his website. I guess it didn't just emerge this week, but that the information gained new salience this week with the Mar-a-Lago search. So Trump had made, after Trump left office, he had made Patel his representative at the National Archives. And he said, that is, Patel said in multiple interviews over the last year that he was going to release classified material to the public that would reveal Russiagate was a hoax or whatever. He had actually a long list of deep state conspiracy theories or derp state conspiracy theories. He actually goes around talking about deep staters, right? This guy was at the highest level of our national security establishment, which is just crazy. So he had all these theories and he vowed that he would expose them by releasing classified info, which is a no-no and a no-no that can get you 10 years in prison, in a federal prison. And in those interviews, and this is also interesting, he alternatively claimed that Trump had declassified a huge stack of documents or like a room full of documents that Trump had said, oh, I hereby declassify all of these documents. And then he also said, again, interchangeably, that Trump made an effort to declassify those documents, but that effort was thwarted by White House lawyers, that there's a process. Trump said, oh, let's declassify every document in the White House. And they were like, that's crazy. We've got, you know, sensitive national security materials in there and stuff that would reveal, you know, sources and methods, which is the kind of crown jewels of intelligence content. Now, I should remind everyone here that the possible crimes listed in the search warrant application for Mar-a-Lago did not require that any of those materials be classified. But it's important in the so-called court of public opinion that they were sensitive, that it wasn't just memos, that Trump didn't just take memos out of the, you know, little trinkets and things to remind himself of the of his time in office. And also, and this may be more important, prosecutors take that into consideration when deciding whether to bring charges. They have discretion. They don't always bring charges if you take government materials home. If it's, you know, just if it's just confidential, low-level stuff, they may they tend not to bring charges. Anyway, and you know, it takes a high bar to charge the former president of the United States. Anyway, as I said, Kash Patel has long been a purveyor of disinformation about national intelligence from within the government. And while I am not a fan of the carceral system, I would love to see him I would love to see him locked up specifically as a result of his reckless disregard for reality, which really undermines people's faith in our institutions and is part of the greater threat to our democracy coming from the right. Right. So constantly trashing the legitimacy of law enforcement selectively when it is focused on the former president and his associates, that is something that undermines the public trust. Also, John Solomon, the right-wing propagandist who for many years posed as a mainstream journalist before becoming a favorite of the fever swamps, may also be implicated in all of this as well. Less likely, but possible. So there's that. Also, before we get to Sarah Posner, on a personal note, it is August, and my district has a congressional election in 5 days. If you live in New York's 19th district, don't wait to vote. Early voting has been underway for a while. This is going to be a low turnout affair, and you should make sure to cast your ballot if you live nearby, if you're local. This is both a very important House race and an unimportant House race. I'll tell you why. But I also want to just take the opportunity to complain about lazy punditry, as is my wont. That's a hobby. Everybody needs a hobby. Bitching about punditry is one of my hobbies. So my former Congress critter, Antonio Delgado, who's on the show, actually, on my former show, sorry, went and became the lieutenant governor of New York State, leaving the 19th CD open. So we're having a special election in August between Democrat Pat Ryan and the Republican, who I deeply dislike, Mark Molinaro. He's a smarmy right-winger who is running a dog whistle campaign, just a classic racist dog whistle campaign. His entire campaign, really the entire campaign, is centered around the Democrat, Pat Ryan, attending a Black Lives Matter protest. And here's the thing, Molinaro also attended the same protest. So he's spending $1 million on ads. Again, classic dog whistle ads about this protest that he attended. So, and that's the state of, you know, Republican politics in 2022. It's all backlash and hypocrisy and bullshit. And whoever wins this race is going to hold that seat for 4 months. In 4 months, redistricting kicks in, the new maps kick in. And where I live in New York 19, will become part of the new 18th district. I hope this isn't too confusing. But this is how redistricting works. Every 10 years, they rewrite the maps. And New York 18 is going to be more Democratic than this one. So this isn't too important in the sense that whoever wins will have the seat for a short time, for 4 months or whatever, and that won't change control of the Congress. It is very important to me, however, in the sense that I am extremely sensitive to lazy political reporting. And if Mark Molinaro wins a low turnout special election in a district that I should point out tilts ever so slightly Republican. This is an absolute swing district. It's a Republican plus 1 point district. Basically a 50-50, almost 50.549. If Mark Molinaro wins in a typically low out special election in a slightly reddish district, the punditry is going to be maddening. It's going to drive me absolutely fucking batty. We are going to face all sorts of like thumbsuckers about how the repeal of Roe v. Wade didn't really fire up Democrats. We're going to hear about how inflation, you know, is really what's on voters' minds, or the insurrection or the Mar-a-Lago search was a midterm game changer, whatever, right? It's all going to be nonsense, because the bottom line is that traditionally Republican groups tend to vote in low turnout elections. So, you know, whatever. We could lose this one. By the way, I know people in that campaign. They're like, this is the first time that we don't know who's going to win. We don't have a good sense. It could go either way. So that's going to drive me batty if it comes to pass. An overinterpretation of relatively minor political happenings is a mainstay of lazy punditry. You see it everywhere, all the time. You take some event and you just inject everything you want to believe or all of your priors into that event. Or you inject everything that will get you clicks or, you know, listeners into it. You project whatever you want onto it as it's a hook, right? And part of that, by the way, is just having to come up with story ideas twice a week or three times a week. I did that for 15 years. And sometimes you're happy to have a hook because you have to file something and you don't always have a great idea of something to write about. So that this is how you end up forming reality sometimes just because you need to write something. Anyway, we have a great example of everything that I was just talking about right now with Liz Cheney's loss in a GOP primary in the incredibly red and Trumpy state of Wyoming. Now, I want to be clear here. There's no question that it's a newsworthy story, right? Cheney is a very very right-wing Republican stalwart. She's a member of GOP royalty. And the party that her family has done so much to promote for so many years, for decades, has taken to calling her a rhino this week, a Republican in name only, which is mind-boggling. And, you know, her only act of apostasy is not being cool with sacking the Congress, right? Or rioting in the Congress as part of a seditious conspiracy. Because Liz Cheney, and it's important to understand this, she is not a never Trumper. She was a very much Trumper, right? She held a fundraiser with Trump in Wyoming to raise money for his 2020 campaign, right? She was all in for him in 2020. She voted with Trump 93% of the time, making her one of the Trump-friendliest members of Congress. This isn't like, you know, there were some other people who voted for impeachment among Republicans, Lisa Murkowski. This isn't like that. This was a real stalwart Republican. So it's newsworthy, and any reporter or pundit accused of using it as a hook for some dumb speculation about like Cheney running in 2024, which she's not going to do. Well, I'll get back to that. Or switching parties or whatever, can defend themselves by saying it's newsworthy and people are interested. And that's true. But how much coverage does it merit? And I say this because, you know, you can't just, if you're a reporter, you can't just say, oh, this is something that's newsworthy. You have to take it into the context of how much attention you're giving it and where you place that attention relative to other stories. Is it the big headline at the top of the newspaper, or is it on page, you know, D17? That's an important question. So, you know, it's the GOP slavish devotion to Trump is not new, right? It's not a man bites dog story that the Republican base does not give a shit that Liz Cheney is a very reliable lifelong Republican. Everybody knew that Cheney was going to lose this primary basically since she voted to impeach Trump, or soon after, as soon as the polls have shown her trailing by 20 plus points for months and months and months, right? Now, I said it's stupid to say she'll run for president. She may well run for president specifically with the goal of getting on the primary debate stage and pushing back against Trump's election fraud lies. There was a piece, I believe in the New York Times this week, suggested that that's a possibility. And the only point would be to have somebody on the primary debate stage, because all the rest of them are going to be going right along with Trump's bullshit and saying 2020 was rigged. She would be the only one who would be like, no, this is nonsense. But she isn't going to be competitive. She isn't going to get into it to win. She'll know that. She is also not going to get a cabinet appointment in Biden's administration. She isn't going to become a Democrat. Democrats don't support her for any other reason except for her tenacious efforts to hold Trump accountable for the insurgency of dunces. And I get that, you know, political reporters, like any other writers, they value conflict. It's what drives a good story, conflict. And intra-party conflict is like catnip, right? And we've seen this so many times. It's like, you know how the 2016 Democratic primaries will never, ever end. We'll be living that for the rest of our lives. They'll always be a touchstone, right? Because reporters love that conflict. Even though in reality, like Bernie Sanders, we've talked about this on the show. He's a pretty pragmatic guy. He's very much a part of the Democratic coalition establishment, even if it doesn't identify as Democrat. Whatever. And one thing that really annoys me about this, Liz Cheney, all over the news, everything today is like Liz Cheney, Liz Cheney, Liz Cheney, is that you have all of this coverage of one Wyoming primary race for one seat in the House of Representatives that's going to be held by a Republican either way. And it has basically pushed the signing of a bill that's a generational investment in clean energy production to page 5 or wherever, out of the headlines. So, and I guess I'll do my share to combat it, because there was this poll out. I'm going to bring it up. Hold on a second. There was a new poll by Data for Progress finds overwhelming support for the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. And they asked people what they thought of 12 different climate provisions. These vary from, you know, various tax credits to the wage and labor standards, to the penalties for oil companies for allowing methane to leak from their operations, whatever. All 12 of these provisions had robust majority support. All 12 were supported by a majority of independents. Obviously, Democrats supported it all. But here's the thing that stands out. 8 of the 12 provisions also enjoyed the support of a majority of Republicans. And none of them were supported by less than 38% of Republicans. That was the least popular among the Republicans, still had the support of 38%. And this is despite the fact that 0 Republicans voted for this legislation. And it's despite the fact that the right-wing media is offering a blitzkrieg of, you know, bullshit attacks on it. It's still really popular, and it would be great if the media acted as if it's the big fucking deal that it is, instead of this primary, Republican primary. Anyway, I have rambled and ranted on enough, so let's take a quick break and then come right back with Sarah Posner. I've had this tune stuck in my head for 3 days, so I'm going to inflict it on you. Here you go. Ooh, baby, I like it more. So I could take it away. Off on the natural charge, Bon Voyage. Yeah, from the home of the Dodgers, Brooklyn squad. Wu-Tang killer, he's on the swarm. Rain on your college ass, disco dorm. Well, you didn't even touch my skill. You gotta go to one killer B, and he ain't gonna kill now. Chop that down, pass it all around. Lyrics get hard, quick cement to the ground. For any MC in any 52 states, I get psycho. Killer, Norman Bain. My producer slam, my flow is like bam. Jump on stage, and then I dip down. Ooh, baby, I like it more. Welcome back. I am always pleased to have Sarah Posner on the show. Sarah and I got our start writing for the same group blog many years ago, and she has gone on to become one of the premier journalists covering the religious right, if not the premier journalist covering the
religious right. She's the author most recently of Unholy, How White Christian Nationalists Powered the Trump Presidency and the Devastating Legacy They Left Behind. The long subtitle. Man, that's a honking subtitle. That came out last year, and she has a piece up at Talking Points Memo, one of several outlets she contributes to at least semi-regularly, about the white evangelical community's response to the raid on Mar-a-Lago. And I shouldn't call it a raid, it's a search. And response is also putting it mildly. Anyway, Sarah, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks, Joshua. It's nice to talk to you.
It's always nice to talk to you, Sarah. I want to ask you about this TPM piece and then also touch on some other events in the news recently. Now, I am struggling to recall a time when the right was flailing as much as it has in response to the search of Mar-a-Lago. Every day they seem to have a different excuse or a different example of whataboutism or a new conspiracy theory that's going to just blow the lid off of this story. That's been especially true after it came out that Trump had been hanging on to highly classified information and refusing for months to return it, even after being subpoenaed and visited by national security officials. It's just, there's no good defense here, so they've just been throwing everything at the wall and hoping that something sticks. Has that also been what you're seeing specifically in the evangelical Christian media, or have they been more focused in their messaging around this because of their belief system?
In some ways, their response has been similar to the response that you might see, say, on Breitbart or from Steve Bannon and people like that. But I think that it's very much zeroed in on the notion that if the FBI could go after our Lord and Savior, Donald Trump, they're coming for us next. So they've definitely wrapped it up in their kind of persecution complexes about secular government coming after Christians. And as I write in the piece, it's so tangled up with all kinds of conspiracy theories and whataboutism and lies and innuendo that for anyone who listens regularly to this kind of media, and trust me, all over the country, there are radio stations that play this stuff all day long, you would come away thinking that the FBI let Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton get away with all kinds of stuff, and Barack Obama too. And they're going after Trump as a politically motivated witch hunt because the FBI has become very woke.
You know, this is something that I've seen in the, in the secular, secular right-wing media. And I think that they really do blend pretty well. This idea that Obama has also somehow evaded prosecution. And with the Clintons, there were a million charges against Bill Clinton, everything from Travelgate to Whitewater, blah, blah, blah. He was very oft investigated. We know that Hillary Clinton had the server. What is the, I've never really heard a coherent argument that Barack Obama has been guilty of any crime. What do they ever specify why he would be charged?
No, and that's why I was saying that it's all filled with kind of this innuendo and conspiracy theories that, the fact that the FBI has gone after and the Justice Department have gone after Trump is proof that they're politically targeting Trump because they never went after these other former presidents or presidential aspirants. So never mind that there was nothing to go after them for, right?
Right.
Yeah. In the mind of the listener, Hillary and Bill Clinton are terrible criminals, child molesters, traffickers in
murderers.
Murderers.
I mean, this all
right.
plays into this, right?
Right. And Barack Obama might be the Antichrist and who knows what else. And so because
he did wear the tan suit. Had the tan suit and the flies.
Oh, far,
the
far
flies
worse.
Around his face. Yeah.
Yeah. It's far worse things than the tan suit. He wasn't even born in America. Remember?
That's right.
I mean, I think
that's
birtherism rings stronger to them the false claims that he's a Muslim or a, you know, some kind of Manchurian candidate. So the base is really primed to think and has been primed to think since the era of Bill Clinton's presidency, when Jerry Falwell and other figures in the religious right played a very important role in distributing and disseminating ridiculous conspiracy theories about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. And so the base has had this fed to them for decades that the Clintons are criminals. And, you know, since Barack Obama started running for president in 2007 or 8, you know, all these conspiracy theories about him. So obviously to them, right, because the FBI has not gone after those people, ipso facto, it must be that they're politically targeting Trump.
And the basic persecution complex, they've been primed for much longer to believe that secular society wants to destroy Christianity, white Christianity in the United States. That goes back, I don't know how far, maybe to the Civil War, maybe before that.
But that's why you see also the comparisons, like this was like the Gestapo, right? So you hear those comparisons. That's a comparison they like to make when they want to say that they're being religiously persecuted, because we all know that the Gestapo did engage in religion and the Nazis did engage in religious persecution. But in this context, even as the judge who signed the search warrant and authorized it was being subjected to a torrent of anti-Semitic attacks, even then, they still use that false comparison that this is like the Gestapo coming after Trump.
They also like the Stasi, the Stasi. That's also popular.
Although I don't think very many people in the base are as familiar with the term. And
mention the Stasi, I'm like, how many of these people know what the Stasi is? I that strikes me every time. I lived in Berlin way back during the Cold War briefly, and so I'm like, oh, Stasi, that's bad. But I wonder if these like guys who are just, you know, eating at a diner, Trump lovers at the diner, like, are sensitive to the threat that the Stasi posed. I think that this is an important, something that people need to understand. It's really important because we've had violence. There's been threats of violence. There's been actual violence. One crackpot attacked an FBI building in Cincinnati. He was gunned down in a standoff with police. And I think that it's super important to understand that people, especially in a well-developed democracy like the United States, we're socialized from a very early age to eschew political violence. Political violence is not something that's natural. We're socialized to believe that you settle things at the ballot box. And one of the ways, and this is what experts will tell you, we've had experts talking about this on the show, one of the ways that kind of hesitancy or reticence to embrace political violence can be overcome is when you tell people that they are under threat and that their violence would be defensive and not offensive. They would not be the people perpetrating the violence. They would be committing violence to prevent violence from being committed against them. So this theme has a real world consequences. I think it's important to point that out. Sarah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add that themes of spiritual warfare and a showdown between good and evil are prevalent and have been prevalent in religious right discourse for a very long time. And I think what we saw on January 6th, just as one example, was that there were a not inconsequential number of people there who I think were taking these themes of spiritual warfare, a battle between good and evil, into the real world and into real world violence.
Right. And it was evident during the riots. I mean, there was a lot of symbolism, Christian nationalist symbolism and the like. Yeah. And related to this, right, you have this, and this is a very dangerous bit of fascist propaganda that's extremely popular on the right now, is this ever present specter of groomers and pedophiles, sexual deviancy. This is meant to kind of dehumanize their opponents and, again, paint their opponents as aggressors, but heinous aggressors. This kind of creeped into the story about the FBI executing a very low-key search warrant at Mar-a-Lago when Trump wasn't even there, didn't it? Like, that kind of theme still got in there somehow. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Trump said or wrote on his social media website, Truth Social, that they had rummaged through Melania's closet. And, you know, this really triggered the base a lot because, you know, the Messiah's wife, the dear leader's wife, of course, is someone to be defended by the deviants in the deep state.
Right.
So it wasn't very hard to set them off by saying that they had, the FBI agents had rummaged through her closet. This was so prevalent in so many of the religious right radio shows and podcasts that I listened to after the Mar-a-Lago raid. It was just stunning how many of them brought it up. And it really goes to their sense of, you know, that their women need to be, you know, their pure women need to be protected from these deviants and these perverts who, you know, might be in there sniffing Melania's underwear or something.
You know, it's just, I mean, I'm not going to trash Melania or anything like that, but the idea that she is this avatar of virtuous womanhood, purity, is interesting. Let's just say it's
interesting. I was going to say comical, but okay.
Comical is another word. This is an area where there is actually a little divergence, I think, between the non-evangelical right-wing media and the evangelical media, because I've seen very little about that like a Newsmax or OAN, those types. I've seen them mention it, but it has not been a central part of this. Another way that they've brought in this whole pedophilia thing is in attacks against the judge who signed off on the warrant. Just as a reality check, he defended some people who were in Epstein's orbit, right?
Right.
Jeffrey Epstein's pilot, I think he defended him in a court case before he became a judge. So he never defended Jeffrey Epstein, but they've called him Jeffrey Epstein's former lawyer, right? That's another.
And of course, there was that notorious Fox News moment when one of the Fox News anchors put up this doctored photo of Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell on a plane together, and someone had photoshopped Judge Reinhardt's face over Epstein's face.
Right. So it looked like he was chilling out with Maxwell.
On the plane with Maxwell, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
With his foot in her breasts.
And then they were like, it was just a joke. Like,
yeah, even it was just a joke. We were just kidding. No biggie.
We pretend that we're a news organization, but that was just a joke. It seems like some have at least implied that Mar-a-Lago, which again, by all accounts, is a kind of dirtbag's idea of an elegant resort. It has lots of like sanitary violations and whatnot over the years. I don't think it's a really nice place. They've implied that it's some sort of hallowed ground. Am I reading too much into some of these quotes?
You are absolutely not. Charlie Kirk was on Eric Metaxas's show. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with Charlie Kirk, but, you know, Eric Metaxas is also very popular among evangelicals, as is Kirk. He's becoming more and more Christian nationalist in his orientation and his rhetoric, and so he's very popular with evangelicals, too. I think people just think of him as a kind of a right-wing campus kind of guy, but he's definitely making inroads in the evangelical world. And he talked about that a lot, that it was that the FBI had desecrated Mar-a-Lago.
Desecrated.
Yeah, so there was a lot of language that suggested that Mar-a-Lago was some kind of holy place that had been sullied in a kind of religious way by the raid.
You write, and I quote, "This toxic brew of conspiracy theories, incendiary language, and veneration of Trump is likely to only get uglier and more dangerous as this and other investigations of Trump progress." And you talk about how some of these folks are contemplating, and I quote, "lawless revenge." What might that look like?
Well, Kirk, for example, talked about how he had texted attorneys, Republican attorneys general, like Ken Paxton of Texas and Jeff Landry of Louisiana, and suggested to them that they should raid left-wing organizations. Not necessarily to arrest anybody, but just, you know, to scare the bejesus out of them or something. These are really like fascist ideas, right? That some, you know, right-wing activist has state attorneys general on his speed dial, I'm dating myself, but, you know, in his contacts on his phone, and he right. feels free to just send them a text message saying, you know what, like, why don't you just raid the offices of our political enemies? And again, here he's talking about Planned Parenthood, Black Lives Matter. He refers to the Alphabet Mafia, which is their slur for the LGBTQ community. He refers to chemical castration of children, which is their slur about gender-affirming care for trans kids. And so he's employing not just the names of organizations like Planned Parenthood or Black Lives Matter, but these slurs that, like you said, are intended as a way of demonizing and dehumanizing, in this instance, LGBTQ people. This is really, I mean, this is extraordinary, dangerous stuff. This is like, you know, he's like very outwardly urging these Republican attorneys general, who we know are not nonpartisan figures, particularly people like someone like Paxton, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, here he is urging them to basically, with no evidence whatsoever, to just go raid the offices of political enemies. I mean, that to me is a very ominous sign about what they, if not will do, would get the base agitated if it doesn't get done.
I think that's a really important point, because they're not only urging that law enforcement raid these organizations, but they're justifying vigilantism if they fail to do so. And they will fail to do so because, you know, I mean, a certain amount of harassment may be expected, but you need to, if you're going to execute a search warrant, you need to convince a judge that you have probable cause that a crime was committed. And right now, as we speak, there are children's hospitals in the United States being besieged with death threats because of exactly these kinds of right-wing lies about castrating children and you know, gender-affirming care. This demagoguery has unleashed just a wave of death threats against all these children's hospitals of all places. and of course, there's a certain degree of hypocrisy in terms of, like, you know, you're losing your mind over a real criminal investigation where they have gone to a judge, they have shown evidence, at least probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And that there are documents that are not, you know, that are the government's property, and they're in a certain place, blah blah blah. And here they're freaking out about that, and here they're calling for this kind of completely lawless, you know, judicial attacks on their opponents. But I was just talking the other day about what a waste of time it is to call out right wing hypocrisy. It's a very popular thing among liberals, you know. Oh, this, look at the hypocrisy. And what a lot of people don't understand is that what we see as hypocrisy is, in fact, authoritarianism, right? People with authoritarian personality types are extremely sensitive to the differences between, like, in-groups and out-groups, members of the tribe, those outside the tribe. So however you want to put it. And they genuinely believe that what's good for the goose is bad for the gander if the goose is in the tribe and the gander is an outsider. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. It's worse than hypocrisy. It's a fascist way of looking at the world, and especially when you're talking about having law enforcement abuse your political opponents who aren't accused of any crimes. Sarah, I'm going to ask you a question that I have asked you before and that I am betting you are asked all the time. I wouldn't be surprised if you're asked this in every interview. Why is it that evangelical right has so tightly embraced a former pro-choice Democrat who is known for womanizing and sexual harassment and using foul language and on and on? Why is that?
The evangelical right does not actually like democracy. And because they feel like it's a threat to their dominance, and pluralism and secularism is a threat to their dominance. And so they rationalized it by saying, well, sometimes God chooses an unlikely leader to lead a nation at a very critical moment in its history. And the critical moment in 2016, of course, was the possibility that, you know, they could get a Supreme Court that would overturn Roe versus Wade, which they did get. But it goes deeper than that transactional relationship that they had with him about judges and judicial nominations and so forth, although that was important. I think in Trump, they see someone who is willing to run roughshod over democratic values and democratic institutions on their behalf. And in that way, he was distinct from every other Republican president that came before him that they had supported, Reagan, both Bushes. And it really goes to their decision to, like I said, run roughshod over democracy in order to carry out their political agenda.
I'd like listeners just to check out a piece that Sarah wrote last year. It's titled "How the Christian Right Embraced Voter Suppression." It speaks to this very issue. Check that out. It was at revealnews.org. I wanted to just ask you, shift gears a little bit before I let you go. You wrote a piece, and this is related. There is a fascist running. I don't know how else you can describe him, running to be governor of Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano. He was involved in the Capitol attack. He organized a bunch of buses of people to go to Washington, D.C., even though he insists he didn't actually enter the Capitol. You wrote a piece recently for TPM about his extremist campaign, and you wrote that his campaign, and I quote, is a result of the explosive growth of politicized, right-wing, charismatic Christianity, a strand of evangelicalism that emphasizes the gifts of the Spirit, such as speaking in tongues, prophecy, direct revelation from God, casting out demons, etc. There's quite a sentence here. Can you unpack that a little bit? Like, what is this new strain, and how prevalent is it within? It's not new, but how prevalent is this strain within the political evangelical right at this point?
I would say at this point it's dominant within political evangelicalism. And that's in part because of politics, but it's also in part a result of just the fluidity of the evangelical world. And what I mean by that is that someone might belong to a Southern Baptist church where there's no speaking in tongues, for example, but they might go to a conference or some kind of other Bible study meeting or something else where the vibe is a lot more charismatic, and there might be people claiming to be modern day apostles and prophets receiving direct revelations from God. And so I think a lot of people mistakenly assume that, like, people go to church on Sunday, that's where they get all of their, like, religious and political info, and it's very sort of contained there. And that is just simply not the case. I mean, there's just so much fluidity in the kind of circles that people move in. Social media has really made that even more pronounced. And even within denominations, the denominations have been flavored, shall I say, with a lot of these charismatic religious practices. So, for example, someone like Mike Huckabee, who I would consider to be like a very prominent figure in the evangelical world, he's an ordained Southern Baptist pastor, and he has referred to himself as a Bapticostal, meaning that he really enjoys or appreciates the sort of Pentecostal charismatic forms of worship. And, you know, so there's a lot of crossover there. I think the lines are not as quite as sharp or distinct. And because that charismatic Christianity that I described in the piece is the overwhelming strand that you see on Christian television, which has really only been around since, say, like the late 1960s, early 1970s, that has just had an enormous influence on evangelicals and charismatics just because of how easily accessible it is now, even more, you know, not just on television, but, you know, YouTube and so on. So I think that that's why we're seeing more people in politics who come out of that world or who have been influenced by that world, including
it's really wow. It's really interesting. So I once went to a Pentecostal service in Pensacola, Florida, and it's a wild experience. Like the speaking in tongues, they flop on the ground like fish. There's a lot of weird shit going on in those churches. They had an awesome rock band, really. Mm-hmm. It was kind of really good band. You could tell everybody was hooking up.
Well, I think also one thing I would say is that the intersection of the belief that you can receive direct prophecies and revelations from God and you may be a modern day apostle or prophet with politics has been a very sort of toxic combination, because obviously, like, if you're going to walk into the political world and say, I can receive direct revelations from God and prophecy that, you know, I'm going to become governor of Pennsylvania. And when I do that, you know, Christ is going to be ascendant in Pennsylvania, something like that. I'm not quoting Mastriano, but that's the tenor of what he says. That kind of crossover with that kind of religious practice with Christian nationalism is pretty dangerous for democracy,
to say the least. Sarah Posner, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Joshua.
I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. And I'd like to thank the good folks at Ross Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me at Joshua Hall. Follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, I would like to thank all of you fine and discerning people for tuning in. Have a great week. Enjoy the last weeks of summer. I'm okay alone, but you got something I need. Well, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key. I think that we should get together and try them out to see. I've been looking around a while. You got something for me.